Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a man who uncovered lost recordings of African Americans from the earliest days of the music industry. Most people who follow this business would point you to the summer of 1920. That's when a vaudeville singer named Mamie Smith recorded Crazy Blues. It was a huge hit, and it's often referred to as the breakthrough moment for black performers in the recording industry. But African Americans were actually recording and selling songs 30 years before that. Tim Brooks is a collector whose CD called Lost Sounds won a Grammy in the historical category. It has the voices of people like George W. Johnson and Harry Burley. And listening to their voices is more than just time travel. It's like listening to good radio today. When you hear the voices, the actual voices, you get to know the people. And we'll do that together right after the news. One reason that radio refuses to die is that we are all drawn to the sound of the human voice. It might be a favorite singer that catches our ear or the voice of a politician saying something that really matters. It might be someone you've never heard before, but when you hear them talk, when they tell their story, you know by the sound of their voice that what they're saying is important to them, and you get drawn in. We all do. There's something about the voices and the music of those early days of jazz and the blues and big bands that give us a feel of that time, a sensation that no written description can match. So what if I told you that collectors can now take us even further back, to the late 1800s and the sound of a street singer of that time? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
If you've never seen one of these original wax cylinders, the ones that were first used for recording in the late 1800s, imagine the cardboard tube that's left when you finish a roll of toilet paper. Now, cut about an inch off the end and coat the outside of the tube with this thick, honey-colored mix of paraffin and beeswax. That's it. Once there's a recording on it, you put it on a horizontal spindle, drop the needle at the start, and you'll get something like this. And that's the voice of George W. Johnson from the CD Lost Sounds, Blacks, and the Birth of the Recording Industry. That's a CD which won a Grammy for the Best Historical Album. And the author of the accompanying book, The Man Behind It All, is Tim Brooks. He's joining us now. Tim, it's nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
When exactly was that recorded?
That was approximately 1894. At the earlier end of Lost Sounds, as a matter of fact. So it did not win a Grammy for high fidelity, as you can tell.
Now, how was that recorded? What was the means?
It was recorded on a wax cylinder without the advantage of amplification or electricity of any kind, as a matter of fact. Edison's original phonograph was a device which recorded by brute sound force on soft wax cylinders that spun around. And that's how that was recorded.
And then you had to play that wax cylinder back. There was no sort of making a cast from that and mass-producing copies, right?
That's right. When the record business started, if you can call it a business, actually every record was an original record. They had to keep recording the songs over and over again to build up stock to sell because there was no duplication. Sometimes they would put four or five phonograph in front of an artist, with their horns sticking toward him, so he could sing it once and get four or five copies that way, but there was no mass production.
So the equivalent of really like in my world, having five or six microphones in front of me, each one making one recording of whatever we're talking about.
I love the picture of the Dixie Chicks or Shakira or something just recording a song over and over again to have enough copies to sell.
Now, what would have been done with that at the time? It clearly wasn't just being recorded for archive purposes or for some collector. Why was it recorded back at that time?
Oh, in the early 1890s, at the very beginning of commercial recording, the recordings were made for exhibition. Very few people had phonographs in their home. Phonographs were rather expensive. So they would make cylinders, the record companies would, and sell them to exhibitors who would travel around the country, set up in the town square, and play this incredible invention that just blew people's mind, that you could have somebody singing out of a box, you know, somebody who was thousands of miles away or somebody who's dead.
Well, what would they do? Would they have people pay a nickel to listen to it? How did it work?
Well, in an exhibition, you might pay to get into the hall.
Oh, I see. Okay. And you had this contraption in the middle of the room.
Yes, which you could barely hear, of course. Or, more frequently, you would have a machine, this acoustical phonograph, and it would have ear tubes, acoustical tubing coming out of it. And most of these records were actually listened to over ear tubes, not over a speaker the way you're listening to them today. So they were meant to be listened to up close and therefore a little clearer, perhaps.
Be a little more descriptive of what these ear tubes were. I'm imagining something like inverted ram's horns sort of coming off.
It's tubing. It's a soft rubber tubing. Then it takes the sound from the stylus or the needle, which is bouncing up and down in the grooves, and it's a little channel that comes right to your ears, so there's no sound getting lost in the open air.
So whoever had the phonograph, what was it called, a phonograph?
It was called a phonograph.
Phonograph. Whoever had that would then charge people one at a time to listen to it using the ear tubes.
That's right, and it was a cottage industry. The Sears catalog would have these coin slot phonographs, and people in the Midwest would buy one and put it in the general store and collect the nickels that people would put in to hear this miracle of recorded sound.
These wax cylinders, do you actually own some of them, or are they all being held in museums somewhere?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, I do own some of these cylinders, and the vast majority of the surviving copies are in private hands, not in archives or institutions. There are some at the Library of Congress and other large institutions, but the majority of them are conserved today by private collectors who care for them. The record labels themselves, if they're still in existence, have none of this.
And so if I came over to your place, would you play one, or would you be afraid of wearing it out a little bit by actually playing it?
Well, cylinders of this period, the 1890s, which are quite soft wax, a brown color, we try not to play them. Play them once to get a digital copy. Cylinders that were made somewhat later in the 1910s, for example, were made of celluloid, and you can play those today without fear of damage.
How did you get interested in this, Tim?
I got interested in the early phonograph industry and recordings back in college. And during the 1980s, there was one name that kept popping up for me that I heard about, read about in articles. And the stories about him were so bizarre and so contradictory that I decided that I was going to see what I could find out about him, maybe do a short article on him or something, clearing up some of this stuff. Because he was apparently the first black recording artist, and quite a popular one at that. And from that small oak, great things grew.
Tim, now that we know a little bit more about George W. Johnson, and we'll talk more about him, I want to just go over the lyrics of the first verse of that song that we listened to. And I can read these. As I was coming round the corner, I heard some people say, "Here comes the dandy darky. Here he comes this way. His heel is like a snowplow, his mouth is like a trap, and when he opens it gently, you will see a fearful gap." And then I laughed. And then we hear him laughing. Is he making fun of himself by calling himself a dandy darky? Is he quoting, you know, sort of white minstrel version of a song that was making fun of African Americans at the time? I don't quite get the humor here.
Oh, absolutely. 1890 was the era of minstrel shows. They were very popular, and of so-called coon songs, which mocked blacks, which made fun of perceived idiosyncrasies, or a lot of watermelon jokes and all that kind of thing. And in order to record, in order to get the gig, the only way he could do it was to sing the songs that the white man wanted him to sing. Johnson himself was in his 40s, which was not young at that time. The average lifespan was about 40. He had been born a slave in Virginia in the 1840s. And he was a street singer and kind of going hand to mouth, singing for passersby in the streets of New York. So he was happy to take the money. And he was a jovial, friendly guy. He had been raised by a white family, actually, and had kind of learned to be comfortable around whites and whites to be comfortable around him. And he was perceived as non-threatening. So when they asked him to sing this mocking song that he sang on the street corners for pennies, he was more than happy to do it. We don't know what he was thinking when he sang it. But in that era, when there was such an incredibly rigid wall between black and white in America, you did what you had to do to get the work and to eat. And so he would sing songs which were essentially mocking his own race.
Let's listen again to George W. Johnson. This is from Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry, and this is a longer version of The Laughing Song.
The Laughing Song by Mr. George W. Johnson. As I was coming around the corner, I heard some people say, and here comes this fight. With a heated life so foul, his mouth is like a trap, and when he moves it in me, or sees me so happy that I laugh. I could study him from there.
Now, Tim Brooks, just to be clear, every time he made a recording of that, he'd have to sing the song again. So all that laughing in time to the rhythm was something that he did over and over and over and over again. Is that right?
That's right. He had a strong pair of lungs, apparently. And that's one of the reasons that the record companies valued him.
How many recordings of that would he have actually made?
Well, he started in the late spring of 1890. And the records, principally that song, The Laughing Song, where he laughs in time with the music, and another one called The Whistling Coon, where he whistles in time with the music, were his two trademark numbers. They sold and sold and sold. Of course, they were selling to exhibitors, but the exhibitors would wear them out, and they'd have to buy more copies. So he kept coming back to the studio to make more and more. And this went on, by the way. It wasn't just the summer of 1890. It went on into 91 and 92, 93, 94, 95, the whole decade, basically. He eventually sold approximately 50,000 copies of those. So he was singing that song over and over and over again, those two songs, for 10 years, and happy to do it because they kept paying him. It only paid him a few cents each time he sang it, but boy, did it add up.
We have pictures on our website of George W. Johnson, as well as one of those early exhibition phonographs with its rubber hose ear tubes. You can find it at thestory.org. Now, Tim Brooks made a passing reference a few moments ago to a genre of songs that 100 years ago carried a name that makes us wince today. He talked about them as coon songs. They were performed by both blacks and whites. We're listening, in fact, to George Johnson again with that song Tim mentioned called, and yes, its real name was The Whistling Coon. I'll talk more with Tim in just a moment about how this music is a window back on the nationwide acceptance of racism that African Americans faced back then. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Whistling Girl by Mr. George W. Johnson for the Columbia Phonograph Company of New York and Paris.
The fact that you just heard the voice of Mr. George W. Johnson is something of a miracle. It was recorded in 1898 on a wax cylinder, and it came close to being lost forever. The loss would have been tragic, as his songs and those of other African-American musicians at the turn of the century really helped give this country its musical identity. Tim Brooks made it his mission to rescue these wax cylinder recordings, many of which have been damaged and in some cases shattered into pieces that had to be put back together again. The result is a Grammy-winning album called Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry. But as Tim explains, it was a painful birth. He and I were talking earlier about the singer you just heard, George W. Johnson, and the racist lyrics in that laughing song. Well, George was also famous for his whistling. He made a lot of money selling a song called, and I'm not making this up, The Whistling Coon. I asked him if he could place that song and that word in context of race relations of that time.
There was a whole genre of songs called coon songs, and they were mocking songs about blacks. And they were sung mostly by whites, but they were sung by blacks as well who wanted to get work on the stage.
Were these whites in blackface making fun of blacks that way, that kind of minstrel singing?
Yes, both in whiteface and blackface, actually. There were staples of the minstrel stage. And in fact, this particular song, The Whistling Coon, was written by a white minstrel performer by the name of Sam DeVere, which Johnson adapted because of a couple of things. First, it fit his persona and the way he made money, which was singing songs mocking black people. Here's this jovial, middle-aged, older black man singing these rollicking songs, making fun of himself. And it also allowed him to use his whistling, because his whistling and his laughing were his two trademark devices that he used in his songs.
Just before we listen to it, walk us through the lyrics. Because it's an old recording, it's a little bit hard to hear. What's he saying?
Sure. This recording is actually from 1891, which is almost the very beginning of a commercial recording. And it starts out, "Oh, I've seen in my time some very funny folks, but the funniest of all I know is a colored individual as sure as you're alive. He's as black as any black crow. You may talk until you're tired, but you'll never get a word from this very funny queer old coon. He's a knock-kneed, double-jointed, hunky-plunky moke, but he's happy when he whistles this tune." And he goes into whistling.
"I've seen in the time of some very funny folk upon the funny river, I know. He's a colored individual, well, I'm as black as any black crow. You'll be talking until you're tired, but you'll never get a word from this very funny queer old coon.
Just to think back to 1891, this singer himself, a former slave, you know, facing all that, white anger over Reconstruction, when there was really no accountability for the mistreatment of blacks, certainly across much of the country. When you think that Johnson was recording in that America, it makes it even more interesting to figure out, you know, what he could do and what he could say and how far he could go, you know?
It was institutionalized separation of the races, the color line, as they called it, in 1890. I mean, there were a lot of people alive then who remembered slavery, of course, in their lifetime. And some, like Johnson, who'd been born into slavery. And what followed the Civil War was not really emancipation. It was slavery under another name, sharecropping and that kind of thing. The whole system rested on this separation of races, one of which was superior and the other was inferior, and they had never known anything else. And yes, there were some who fought that. There were the Booker T. Washingtons W.E.B. Du Boises and people, but they were a tiny minority. They were just getting their voice.
So did George W. Johnson remain a sort of lone recording artist, or did he become a part of the sort of minstrel show circuit performing as he did?
He didn't set any records in terms of advancing social agendas, but of course that wasn't his goal. What he did do, in addition to making his own very hard life a little better, was kick open the doors for others who would come along later and could record other kinds of music. He showed into this very segregated world that a black American could actually sell records in an unthreatening way and make money for these entrepreneurs who were trying to get their record companies started. They were struggling at that time. And by setting that precedent, by making the best-selling records of the entire decade of the 1890s, those two songs of his, he showed that you weren't taking such a risk if you would let a black man into your studio.
Right.
So he kind of opened the doors for others who would come later and could do other kinds of music.
One of your recordings is called Minstrel First Part. It comes from 3 years later, 1894. Tell me why you included this in the collection.
Yeah, that's an interesting story because Len Spencer, a young white man, was a real entrepreneur, kind of a hustler, really, in the early 1890s. And he came up with the idea of, why don't I put together a 2 or 3 minute audio example of what a minstrel show sounds like. And he pitched that to the record companies, and they bit. So he put together a little repertory company to make these little snapshots, audio snapshots, of the opening of a minstrel show, which is called the Minstrel Show First Part. His little company consisted of himself, another white comic. Usually he used an Irish tenor or some rather formal white tenor to sing the big song at the end of the cylinder. And the other member was George W. Johnson, the black recording artist. So it was an integrated group, basically. And what he used Johnson for was to sing his song, the laughing song, as the featured number on some of the cylinders. And then the rest of the cylinders, he used him for that hearty laugh of his. He kind of was the audience effect in a way. And Johnson kept recording for Len Spencer for the next 10 years.
Introductory overture.
This group of people chasing these wax cylinders and later the discs, I mean, I have this image of a small, tightly knit group of audio anthropologists, of which you are one. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
That's a fair characterization. It involved correspondence with collectors around the world, tracking down who's got a copy of this, who's got a copy of that. And finding these records was devilishly hard.
Tim Brooks has tracked the earliest years of the recording industry, looking also at the switch from these wax cylinders to discs made of hard rubber. Here's a recording made in 1898 by the singers Cousins and DeMoss, and it takes us a bit closer to the more familiar sound of early African American music.
And that's really what African Americans brought into the very stilted world of Victorian America. They brought what we'd call today soul. They brought a looseness and a rhythm that had been missing before in Anglo-American music.
And you can hear in that some of the very early beginnings of rhythm and blues in that looseness, can you not?
Yes, and one of the things I learned in the process of going through this and digging out this history was that the reason they were able to record that way is that the white recording managers didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand this music. So they basically said, well, whatever it is you do, do it, you know, and we'll sell it as a novelty.
Now, basically. I had never seen the names Cousins and DeMoss. Were they noted? Were they known at the time as recording artists or performing artists?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, they didn't normally perform together. Sam Cousins and Ed DeMoss were two minor league black vaudevillians who did the Chitlin circuit, so to speak. They knew each other, but they didn't perform together generally. And apparently what happened is in the summer of 1898, this disc company was trying to build up their catalog with some of these novelty sounds, and one of their scouts heard these two performing separately and said, hey, could you guys come down to the studio? We'll pay you, you know, $20 or something like that, and do a few of those numbers, whatever they are that you do. And Sam and Ed said, sure, we'll come down and we'll plunk up a storm for you. And so this is probably unique in having Cousins and DeMoss together, and there's no evidence they performed together afterwards either.
So how did you know what you had when someone produced the disc for the first time?
Well, that's an interesting story, because the first time we'd seen the name Cousins and DeMoss in catalogs, but nobody had any of their discs. And I was on a record hunting expedition with some friends of mine, and one of them was named Dick Spotswood, and he came across this Berliner disc that had those names on it. So we put it on a phonograph just to see what it was. He was trying to figure out whether to buy it or not, and played it, and the sounds that came out of that tinny little phonograph were just amazing. We didn't even know at that time whether they were black or not, but listening to the music, we thought, boy, they sound like it. So that was one of those moments when you put on a record not knowing what to expect, and you're just blown away with what comes out of the speaker.
Tim Brooks' Lost Sounds are both a CD and a book, and we have links on our website if you want to know more. You'll find it all at thestory.org. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. It's not all music. In one of Tim Brooks' searches, he came up with a spoken word recording of the boxer, Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion. Tim says that Johnson's most often described today as a provocative and flamboyant fighter, but that's not what comes across in a 1910 recording of his voice that Tim found.
That was one of the jaw-dropping moments, I must say, when I first heard that record. There have been half a dozen books at least about Jack Johnson, the first heavyweight black heavyweight champion, and they portray him as this bold, poking his finger in white America's eye, living large. And you wonder, how was it he didn't get shot or hung? I mean, blacks just weren't allowed to do that.
He had fast cars. He hung around with white women. This was at a time when...
He married white women. My Lord, talk about something that was unheard of at that time and not allowed. So how was that possible? Well, you listened to this heretofore unknown recording, which was actually made in 1910, just a few weeks after the famous Great White Hope fight, where he secured the heavyweight championship. Huge, huge media event. It was all over the papers. There were riots after the fight because, of course, he won, and James Jeffries, the white champion, the Great White Hope, had come out to defeat him and put this black man in his place, had been defeated. And there were riots. People were killed. And what happened was that an enterprising company, film company in New York, hired Johnson to simply describe the fight, to stand there in their studio in his street clothes, mouthing the words. Of course, it was a silent movie. So then he went into the Columbia Studios and recorded the soundtrack, basically. And this is the soundtrack to that now lost film, where he's deliberately describing each round in the fight. And what comes through is not this bravado and not this outrageous kind of Muhammad Ali kind of behavior at all. It comes across as a very calm rather intelligent sounding man who is unfailingly courteous toward his opponent. He compliments Jeffries several times on being a great fighter. His tagline, Johnson's tagline, is "May the best man win." He was obviously playing on fight fans' sense of fair play. They were mostly racists, but Johnson was a superb fighter. He had fought extremely fairly, and he was playing to that sense of fairness that sports fans like to think they have. And it's a whole different picture of Jack Johnson.
Ladies and gentlemen, with your kind indulgence, I will endeavor to say a few words in regard of the great heavyweight battle which took place 4th of July of this year between myself and one of the gamest and greatest heavyweights that ever laced on a boxing glove.
You know, my question is, Tim, how do you know that's Jack Johnson? It's got, such a sort of elegant, mannered, metered presentation. Couldn't it have been someone else?
As a matter of fact, the collector I bought that from said he didn't think it was Johnson. It didn't sound like a black man. He later apologized for that comment, by the way. And it turned out that Johnson, that wasn't the only recording Johnson made. He made recordings in 1914 when he was in Europe about training and conditioning. He made some more recordings in the 1920s. So I compared these recordings to establish that it was, in fact, Jack Johnson. And yes, it's Jack Johnson.
So what do we learn? That we need to beware the sort of Sports Illustrated writing of 1910 that described him as this whatever they described him as, fast-talking, provocative, kind of in-your-face fighter, and reassess him based on the way he actually sounds when he's recorded.
They described him in terms worse than that, actually, a real animal. And a lot of those interviews and supposed interviews with him were, in fact, made up by the reporters. They would attribute to him kind of gutter-like street slang and yassas and ignorant kinds of constructions, because that's the picture they wanted to portray.
That's in the same way slave narratives are often written with bad grammar and whatnot, just to sort of emphasize a difference in class and culture.
Exactly. And once in a while, however, you would find an actual transcript. And there was a transcript in Variety, I believe, of one of Jack Johnson's speeches from the stage during his vaudeville career. The fighters all went into vaudeville after their big fights in those days. And it reads surprisingly like that record we just heard. And according to the review in Variety, the audience started being very anti and booing and jeering and hissing, the white audience, and by the end of his speech, they had come around to his side. So this is how, it's no accident that most pictures of Jack Johnson show him surrounded by white people, not black people.
Our examination of Tim Brooks' Lost Sounds continues in just a moment. We're going to go back to the music and how some of these lesser-known recordings and artists influence not just ragtime and jazz, but classical music as well. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I've been talking with Tim Brooks about the album he helped put together. It's called Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry. Tim tells this one story about a wax cylinder that was all but shattered and how one of his colleagues, a man with the sure hands from years of dental training, was able to put it back together. Well, it played, sort of, but digital sampling and enhancement rescued a piece of music, a piece of the musical history of this country, that would otherwise have been lost forever. Tim was telling me about the surprise, the wait to hear what comes out of the speaker. And one of those surprises for him was a recording of Harry T. Burleigh.
Well, Harry T. Burleigh was another one. Several books have been written about him, and they all say he never recorded, so we'll never know what he sounded like. Well, he did record, and now we know what he sounded like.
Let's listen to a little bit of Burleigh singing Go Down Moses, and then we'll pick up the story once we've heard that.
Go down.
His place in history is really secured because as a young man, a young black man, he came to New York in the early 1890s and was admitted to the National Conservatory of Music. The honorary director of the conservatory at that time was none other than Antonin Dvorak, the great European composer, who was in the United States writing a symphony, which would ultimately become his greatest symphony. And Dvorak, an old man, was absolutely fascinated by the songs that Burleigh sang for him, these spirituals, this black music. He'd never heard anything like it. And he took Burleigh under his wing, and Dvorak was influenced by this exposure to black spiritual music from the young student, Harry T. Burleigh. He incorporated those sounds in the New World Symphony, in the Largo. He also, importantly, made a statement that was widely published at the time, look to African Americans, look to African American music. That is the future of American music, he said. That was an outrageous statement to make in 1894, but it was coming from somebody coming to our shores from another country and saying, you're missing something here. This is perhaps the most original music in America.
Let's listen to just a tiny piece of Dvorak's New World Symphony. Once again, Tim Brooks, we have this sort of anthropological dig back through sounds where if you want to know more about the influence on Dvorak and you actually get to listen to Harry T. Burleigh's voice and singing, you get a little bit closer to exactly what he was hearing.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, and you begin to realize not only where he got it from, but how much influence it had at the time. And it turned out to be quite influential, and by the 20s it gave birth to a whole explosion in African-American themes in American music.
I asked Tim Brooks to talk a bit more about how the music he discovered began to mix with more popular music, like ragtime and jazz. He told me the story of two white dancers, Vernon and Irene Castle. The Castles were the toast of New York, and they enlisted the first black orchestra to record in the U.S. It was called Jim Europe's Society Orchestra.
They had a second orchestra, which was their white orchestra, which played kind of soporific waltz music. But they wanted a hot orchestra because they were young and they were inventing dances like the foxtrot and these athletic, the Texas Tommy, all these athletic dances. And they wanted an orchestra that was up to that, and the white orchestras couldn't play that kind of music. So they hired a rather daring thing for them to do. They hired Jim Europe's black orchestra to play for them. So they got him into the great estates of Long Island, the great clubs and venues of Manhattan among the elite. And in 1913, they greased the way for Europe to, in fact, record for the Victor Talking Machine Company, which was the biggest record company of the day. And the records he made in 1913 and early 1914 just blew the door jams off. They were clearly the first stabs at jazz.
Tim, I was going to ask you if that was off speed until I heard that man's voice in the background.
No, you hear them yelling in the background there? Yeah. I mean, goodness sakes, you didn't hear that on records then.
People they're going yelling so fast, right?
Yes. Down Home Rag was a showpiece, and boy, they really tear into that thing.
And that's the musicians calling out to each other in the background? There isn't a vocalist
yes.
as a part of that.
That's right. They're just like urging each other on. So again, it really upended the Victorian type of music making and set the stage for what became the jazz we know of the 20s.
I'm wondering if in the time that you've been gathering this material and cataloging it and talking to other collectors and publicizing it as you do now, if you've seen a change in the way that it is accepted. Are people more ready to figure out where it fits in this country's musical history than they were even 20 years ago?
Yes, I think that is happening. It happens gradually. There are some that will never give up their old way of thinking, of course. But there are lessons in here for our own time. I'm firmly convinced of that. You know, how did these black artists in such a segregated time make their music? How did they gradually soften their music so that they weren't singing coon songs by 1920? Well, they did it because white entrepreneurs, people in the record companies, voice teachers, would give them a break. You know, it's not only this passing laws and standing on the barricades and the waving of fists. Sometimes it's helping people out when you know they should be helped and not being afraid of convention and doing it. And when you trace back through their stories, you learn things that I think could be instructive for us today in further reducing the barriers that unfortunately still exist.
Tim Brooks produced his album for Archaeophone Records, and it's called Lost Sounds, Blacks and the Birth of the Recording Industry. My conversation with Tim inspired one listener, Katarina Cherny, to email me. Katarina said, "When I was a child growing up in the former Czechoslovakia in the 1950s and 60s, my father sang Negro spirituals every night to me and my sister. She said that even though I didn't understand the words, I, like Dvorak, loved the melodies. I always wondered," wrote Katarina, "why my father, who trained as an opera singer, was so drawn to those spirituals." Well, I caught up with Katarina. My first question to her was how well she remembered her father singing those spirituals to her.
My father sang for my sister and me every single night. He would put us to sleep. He played the guitar. And many years later, when I had children and my sister had children, he sang those same songs to them to help them fall asleep. And we continue this tradition to this day.
Did it put you to sleep, or did you stay up listening to your dad?
Oh, we listened, but it helped put us in a mood for sleeping and relaxation.
He recorded a number of the songs that he sang, and we actually have a recording of your father singing the old Paul Robeson song, My Curly-Headed Baby. And your father's no longer with us, right? He passed on some years back?
Yes, he died 5 years ago.
So this is kind of a bit of a treasure that he left you, that you get to continue listening to his voice, singing the songs that he sang to you when you were a girl.
It's wonderful to have the tapes. And we continued singing the songs even when we were no longer children. Whenever my sister and I visited my dad and my mom in Minneapolis, every day he would take out the guitar and we just sing. Sometimes he'd go on and on for hours, and we all joined in. And when our children were a little older, they would join in. So he has left us a wonderful legacy.
Let's have a listen to the voice of Ladislav Cherny. This is the song that he used to sing his daughter Katarina to bed at night.
Oh, my baby, my little baby, your teddy's on the cotton field a working for the goon. So la 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 la, bye bye. Do you want the moon to play with and the stars to run away with? They'll come if you don't cry. So la 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 la, bye bye.
I was waiting to hear you sing along, Katarina.
I only sing in the privacy of my house.
I need to remind myself here. Now, your father grew up in what we knew as Czechoslovakia. You did too. Had he ever heard these songs performed?
He had never heard the songs performed. Somehow he managed to get the sheet music for the songs, and I believe it was through a friend who lived in Sweden who mailed them to him when he was a young man. I think he was only a teenager at that time. And he learned them. There was something about the songs that inspired him. Maybe it was the fact that Czechoslovakia, when it was taken over by the communists, it didn't quite turn out the way that people had hoped. And so maybe he found some comfort in the songs of people who lived in a country whose language and culture they didn't understand.
Well, these were also the songs of oppression, you know?
And songs of oppression, exactly. He could certainly identify with those feelings and the messages in the spirituals.
Did he ever sing them in places that you thought were less than appropriate? I mean, did he ever sing them in public?
Yes, he did.
He
loved to perform. He would burst into song in restaurants. If he was in a building that he thought had good acoustics, he would always test the acoustics and start singing.
I think that's great. Now, I
have another. Can I tell you another story?
Yeah, please.
Okay. When he got cancer and he would go for his chemotherapy treatments, he sang in the chemo room to cheer people up. And they
loved. This is while he's getting chemotherapy.
This is while he is getting chemotherapy. In the chemo room, he is singing. And the room would just brighten up when he walked in. Everybody knew him and everyone felt better while he was there.
And just so I'm clear, he recorded these songs after he knew he had cancer, after he knew he was dying. So they were, in effect, something that he was leaving for you and your sister and your children, right?
Yes. It's a wonderful gift. It's great. It's so nice to have these songs, and I feel like I'm with him again every time I play them.
I'm going to close my eyes here, and we're going to play a piece of another one of his songs, but I'm going to close my eyes and imagine the chemotherapy room at a hospital and Ladislav Cherny in there for his own chemotherapy singing.
My Lord.
What goes through you when you hear that, Katerina?
Oh, I'm crying. but I'm also happy because I remember when he would wake us up with that song for many years. That was the first thing I heard in the morning was my dad singing, "My Lord, What a Morning." And I knew it was going to be a good day.
You know what I find so fascinating about it is that, you know, think of the map of the world and the songs that originated in the southern United States and somehow made their way to Czechoslovakia, and here he is recording them and bringing them back to America with his own little take on them.
Yeah, it's amazing. And now, after hearing that segment about Dvorak, I understand why he was inspired and fascinated by these songs, because Dvorak was his favorite composer, and he sang Dvorak's biblical songs and arias from Dvorak's opera Rusalka. And so Dvorak inspired him to search for these songs. But I must tell you, shortly after he died, we turned on the TV, and my husband and I were talking about my dad and his songs and how he loved singing "Oh My Baby." And at that moment, "Oh My Baby" came on this TV show, which was really about classical music. So I felt that was a sign that he was still around and still sharing his favorite music with me.
You may not be wrong. I mean, just the fact that you heard about this connection on the story and got in touch with us. I mean, maybe that's your father helping you make some connections that weren't made while he was still alive.
Oh, I agree. I think he's listening to us right now and having a great time.
Well,
he always was a performer, and he loved listening to himself perform.
And now a national radio program. I mean, how good does it get?
Doesn't get any better than that.
I am honored to have his voice and to have had you as a guest on the story. Katerina, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Katerina Cherny joined me from a studio in Detroit. It's too tempting not to take this one step further, the impact of black spirituals. The singer, Paul Robeson, who inspired Ladislav Cherny, was well aware of the power of the music in Europe. He praised Dvorak for finding in this American music the essence of a struggle for freedom. He included it in his own performances. Robeson even learned the Czech and Yiddish versions of his own songs. The musical expression of suffering in America was exploited politically as well. In 1949, when the Soviet Union was equally eager to underline the flaws in America's capitalist history, Paul Robeson was invited to perform in Moscow's Tchaikovsky Hall.
So lullaby, do you want the stars to play with?
or the moon to run away with. They'll come if you don't cry. So la-la-la-la-la-la-la-bye-bye. In your mother's arms be creeping, and soon you'll be a-sleeping. La 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 la.
That's Paul Robeson singing in Moscow 59 years ago. And that's our show for this week. If you have thoughts about what you hear on the story or a story of your own, something you'd like to share, you can get to me through our website at thestory.org. The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowood. Rachel McCarthy does much of our audio editing. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of the program is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.